Thanks for the kind introduction and for inviting me to the workshop. So this is a different title from what I gave you for the program, and I decided that I will talk about the question of dendritic arbors and our theoretical effort to explain what it is, rather than focus on EM reconstruction, but which you heard from Sebastian. But I will take an opportunity and tell you a little bit about the reconstruction. If you want to know more, feel free to ask me. I'm always happy to talk about it. So the question that I want to, address this question is not focusing on the developmental mechanism that produced the shape of neurons, but rather try to understand why neurons are the way they are. And the hope is that if we answer enough of those questions, we will be able to make structure-function relationships explicit and make inferences about brain function from the structure that is observed by various reconstruction methods. And so the particular question of the shape of dendritic arbors is can be well introduced using these two pictures. And these are the two main heroes of the story that I'm going to tell you. And this is a pyramidal cell. There are a lot of those in the cerebrum. And this is a Purkinje cell. And there are maybe fewer of those, but it's still a rather big cell class in the cerebellum. As you can see, the dendrites here, they also have the spines, which will play an important role. And one major difference between these two cells is their dimensionality. So the dendrites of the pyramidal cell are really three-dimensional objects, while the Purkinje cell is flat, as you can see in this picture. This animation runs for a little while. To show how flat the cell really is. So now you can see how flat it really is. And the answer that I'm going to give you to the question of what determines the shape of those cells is based on maximizing the functionality of dendrites. And of course, dendrites can do many interesting things like nonlinear computations and so on. But I think the principal function of dendrites is to conduct electrical signals from postsynaptic terminals to the cell body. And that's the main functionality that we're going to consider that we will assume is optimized by their shape. Of course, just maximizing functionality isn't enough. There needs to be a cost to doing something. And the balance of that cost that I will explain in a little while, how we describe the cost and how we describe the functionality exactly, it will become clear how the trade-off between the two will explain the shape. But before I can do that, I want to make sure that you have just the right picture in mind about how the neuropil is organized. And what's wrong with these pictures? Well, what's wrong is that here, only one cell is labeled, and therefore imaged, out of tens or even hundreds of thousands of cells that exist or whose processes exist in that area of neuropil. So this is a highly selective image. And those images, of course, made their way in textbooks. And so some people, of course, none of the people in this room, but some people think that, you know, neurons kind of live in a vacuum in the brain. But to dispel that notion, what we want to do is to zoom in and use a different technique, which is the electron microscopy reconstruction, which is a high resolution technique. And so we have to limit ourselves to like small volume like this one and actually figure out what's in there.
So just wait. So you're saying that the dendrite is for communication, not for computation. Is that sort of the...
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the principal function of a dendrite is to communicate synaptic inputs. Okay. If you are not communicating synaptic inputs, you cannot do any computation. Okay? So, and that's the only thing we will use, and we will be able to explain the shape.
So, conduction of the spike factor, the synapses, that's also a factor, right?
But on the level that we're doing, that's not going to be very much, very different from conducting postsynaptic currents to the cell body. Okay, so this is my opportunity to tell you a little bit about the EM reconstruction project. So what we do is, I think I have to press it. Yeah, so what we do is we take a chunk of the brain like the size that I showed you and section it into really thin slices. So they're 50 nanometers thick. And then you put each slice under electron microscope. You make a series of images. The contrast comes from cell membranes that are darker. And then you have to align those images and segment them. And so this is the
color electron microscope.
The electrons are purple, so there aren't many colors available. And then you have to link the two-dimensional cross-sections into three-dimensional shapes. And what we're, of course, are interested in synapses. And if you can trace axons and dendrites from synapses that can be identified with AM to cell bodies, then you can draw arrows between neurons and have the whole wiring diagrams. So that's, of course, a big project. And the only full wiring diagram was done in C. elegans. That's the project that we contributed to. It was started in Cambridge by John White in Sidney Brenner's group, but they actually haven't completed the project. And so when we got into this business a few years ago, as a warm-up exercise, we completed the wiring diagram of C. elegans. So we have the complete connectivity matrix. I can show you if you want. But the point is that this process is really has a bottleneck in the very last step. So the preparing tissue and image acquisition for a volume as big as this, which is, of course, small, takes only a few days. But once you have the photographs, reconstruction may take years. And so what we are working on, just like Sebastian, is trying to automate that reconstruction process.
There's manual.
Yeah. So C. elegans took, 20 man years to complete at least. Because there are 10,000 slices and you have to trace individual axons and dendrites to all those slices. Okay. So instead we already invested about 4 years into the automated algorithm and hopefully.
So that's
difficult. I have a comparison. I can show you later. Yeah, it's like 1,000 of a cubic millimeter. So this is what an electron microscopy image looks like. And now this is getting back to the topic of the talk. So this is from the cerebellum. And this is that small volume that I showed you. And this is the dendrite of the Purkinje cell. And it's branching here. Okay. And what you see here are cross-sections of individual axons. They're called parallel fibers or granule cell axons that could synapse on that dendrite. And they all run in one direction perpendicular to the orientation of the section. Okay?
Each of the small cell is a cross-section, right?
Yes.
Each small...
Yeah. It's an axon.
Are you mining?
No.
Can you point to a synapse between a granular cell axon and a
dendrite? I'll prefer this to do in my own image.
Just see a PSD.
Yeah. Let me.
Is that proximal? Because they didn't seem to be spines.
You can't see. On one section, you can't see very well whether there are spines or not. So that's why you need to reconstruct a series of sections. So individual section looks like that. And here is the scale, this 5 micron. But just to give you better intuition, this is a capillary. So this is, blood vessel. This is a cell body. So it's really big, just the size of this image, and you only get a corner. This is another cell body. And there is about 100 synapses here. And then...
Where's the dendrite of the Purkinje cell?
This is now cortex. Okay. Sorry, but there are hundreds of dendrites and thousands of axons here, okay? And this is one of the synapses. So I blew it up. The reason you know it's a synapse, there are vesicles here that can excrete neurotransmitter when the signal comes. And they, this is synaptic cleft, and this is for synaptic density, and this is a spine. Okay? So this is how we know there is a synaptic connection. And that's easy. What is hard is to know which two neurons are talking here. Because then you would have to trace and decide whether this axon goes to that cell, to this cell, or even more likely than that, to some cell that is not even in this section, because there are axons of thousands of cells included in this picture. So that's what why it's a hard problem.
Can you show an axon here?
Well, this is an axon. Well, a bouton of an axon. If it's not, it's probably like this is probably an axon. It's not always possible to be completely sure from one section. You have to do reconstruction from several sections. But these are likely to be axons.
So what are the large structures that are either axons or cell body?
So, by the way, sorry, just to answer your previous question, this is a myelinated axon. Okay, large dark structures are mitochondria. Okay, and they're a nuisance, of course, in the reconstruction because the algorithm confuses them with the external membrane.
Just because I forgot to ask this previously, what's your guess on the number of myelinated axons in cortical matter?
Oh, it depends on which animal and which layer.
What's your favorite area?
Well, red barrel cortex layer 4, there are very few, so this is the only one in this image. Oh, here's another one, sorry.
There's another one.
Where?
Right in the edge in the middle of the
region. Yeah, you're right. But, you know, there are 1,000 of them here, so you can only find 3 of them. All right, so getting pulled away from the main topic. Oh, by the way, this is the C. elegans wiring diagram. You can get it off my website.
So what is the variability in C. elegans?
We only have 2 animals to compare, and they're roughly 75% similar.
Okay. What does that mean?
So that means that if you have a synaptic connection in one worm, what are the chances that there is a synaptic connection in the other worm?
Does that mean the 2 cells are connected or that the synapse is in the same place?
2 cells are connected.
So, in order to compare, you need...
This is an underestimate because if the connection has more than one contact, then it will be present in another worm with almost 100% probability. But if it only has one synaptic contact, then it may or may not exist. So that's where the variability comes.
If the 2 synapses in the same place, the measure of identity would be much lower.
That's a difficult question because when they reconstructed, they did not put the synapse location in the computer, and so it's really...
So I guess I have a related question, what the same place means. So in order to compare, you need to align. So how does one, if one were to... compare little patches of tissue between the two samples. How does one begin to align them?
That's a very difficult issue, and I would say in the worm, there may be a way of doing that, or in the fly. Certainly not in the mouse.
But presumably you don't want to align by, in real space, you want to align by identity of neurons.
Yeah, no, by identity in the worm, the alignment is perfect. So in the worm, neurons are reproducible from worm to worm. And, the neurons even have names, so it's perfect in the topological space. I thought you were asking about the physical space.
They have a name in the lineage, but how do you map that, identify positions in your 3D?
They're the same in every worm.
Okay, so it is just mapping space after all.
Yeah.
With
in the worm it is, but in higher animals it's not. Okay.
Two worms, if you can compare how close they are to each other.
They're genetically identical. Okay, so so how far did we get with the reconstructions? And this is an example of a volume reconstruction. It's approximately 8 by 8 by 8 microns. So it's kind of small, but it is already has 1,000 different components. And so this is from CA1 stratum radiatum from rat hippocampus. So this is an apical dendrite or segment of an apical dendrite. And you see it has quite a few spines. And of course, the reason they're there is because there are axons shown in green that run by, and they could make synapse on that dendrite. But I only showed you one axon, and there's more than 600 of them. So I can dial randomly a few more axons to give you an idea of what this thing is like.
Not quite random.
Quasi-random. Quasi-random. Okay, and then we can look what we get. And then you get, you know, this sort of thing. And
can you highlight the synapses?
Yes. So now I'm going to turn on all the synapses, which will be visualized by red disks representing postsynaptic densities. And so now you have all the synapses in this volume, and you can see that some of them, some of the synapses actually sit where they're supposed to sit, on a bouton or on a spine, but a lot of them are floating in the air. And the reason this happens, of course, is because I didn't show you all the axons that live this in this volume. And if I show you all the axons, then you get something like this. And so now all the PSDs, they actually correspond to some bouton, and you get this jungle-like structure, which is what the brain is really like. And there are a lot of holes. And the reason that there are holes is because I didn't show you all the dendrites. And so if I show you all the dendrites, then you'll have this thing which now starting to look like a tightly packed block of tissue. Okay? And there are still remaining holes, and that's because I didn't show you all the glia. And then if I turn on the glia, then it's pretty much space filling.
The original picture had only one dendrite? The original picture.
The original?
You started one before adding.
Yes. But there are many more dendrites in this volume. Okay? And then.
So yesterday we heard the assertion that half the brain's volume is glia and half is neurons.
Well, it depends if you include white matter or gray matter. So in white matter, obviously, there's a lot of glia because myelin is glia. But in gray matter, it's 8% or so. So we can take out that original, dendrite that I started with, and we can fly into this tunnel that was formed, that is formed by the absent dendrite. And then you can look around, and then you can figure out who the neighbors of this dendrites are. And one of the discoveries we made actually that it's, the walls are mostly green here, very few yellow. So most of the neighbors are axons, which was unexpected at least by us. And then there is a lot of glia because glia always goes where synapse. So that was just a little show to give you an idea of what the neuropil is really like, and to get away from the picture of the individual neurons sitting in a vacuum, but rather to the space-filling picture.
So Michio, yeah. So recently we saw this talk by Kevin Brigman where they fixed the tissue differently, and
yep.
The idea is that there's actually in the live brain lots more extracellular space. So that would influence things like whether you have to draw a spine to make a contact or whether they're really right next to each other.
Yeah, so that's a very good point. The exact estimate of the extracellular space fraction is unreliable from traditionally fixed EM tissue. And there are indications that previously came from a high pressure freeze-free substitution fixation, and now from other fixation methods, and also from diffusion measurements in vivo that show that extracellular space is not 10% like we calculate, but probably more like 20%. So there is some more space between neurons, but I don't think this affects the space-filling packing argument, because what also happens when you fix the tissue differently is that processes become much more round. So here they're kind of taking this shape so that they will have a lot of corners. But if you do this other fixation, which is probably more more truthful, then the processes are rather cylindrical. And then, of course, when you pack a lot of cylinders, there are corners where there is nothing, or there is extracellular space. So the packing, I think, is still pretty tight. It's just that there's more extracellular space.
I have a hard time reconciling these really dense block of tissue, the brain with relatively little intracellular space, with the images you see from Charles Fabot's lab and these things of these, fine heads moving around and flopping around. How do you reconcile that? Is it
something has to move out of the way.
Yeah.
This is a very live, breathing structure.
There's a lot more space.
In your retina,
in a
24-hour cycle, I mean, connections at low light pull apart, the connections at high light come back together. Mm-hmm.
Because the other thing you've been pushing is equally deformable as the surrounding tissue, but I guess,
I should comment as a biologist that most of your body looks like this, but in most of your body, but not in the brain, there are macrophages crawling through the tissue all the time looking for bugs.
That's a really good point.
Living systems do quite well.
That's a really good point.
I mean, we probably need them.
These issues that, one issue is the space filling, the other one is how much it takes.
Exactly. That's right. Okay. So this was a little bit of a distraction, but the point that I wanted to make for the purpose of my talk is that this is a space-filling tissue, and the Purkinje cell lives in the sea of axons that all run in one direction into the screen. But the pyramidal cell lives in this kind of environment, which is also space-filling. But axons, as you saw, run in all different directions. So I can go back, and these are axons. You can see they go in all different directions. So these are the two differences. And for the first part of the talk, I want to focus on the situation of the Purkinje cell, where all axons run into one direction, because I think it's simpler to understand. And then we will move over to the pyramidal cell. So as I was saying, we were going to explain the shape of dendritic arbors by minimizing the cost. But how do we know what the cost is? Presumably if you write down different cost function, you'll get a different result. So what I'm going to do is to propose two rather generic assumptions about dendritic costs that we think are rather reasonable, and show that they're both necessary and sufficient. So again, we're considering a dendritic arbor in the sea of axons, and these circles represent cross-section of axons. They go into the board. And that arbor, of course, wants to make synapses with those axons. And the first assumption we make is that cost grows with total dendritic length. And that's easy to justify once you saw those pictures. You know, the volume is a limited constraint, and a volume is proportional to length. So you have to pay something for building a longer dendrite because you're taking up a volume that could be used by someone else for something useful like synapses or other dendrites and so on. And we can show that this is a necessary assumption, because if you did not have this assumption and you did not limit the total length, then you could connect each synapse that is made with axons by a dedicated branch directly to the soma. But then the total length would be, of course, huge, and so this thing never happens. So this is a necessary assumption.
You have to assume uniform diameter for the dendrites for this?
Yeah, so the issue of diameter is a little tricky, but even if you took the smallest possible diameter, which presumably exists, and Simon has a paper showing that it exists for axons, but I think the same argument, similar argument could be made for a dendrite. It's a smaller minimum diameter. There are so many synapses that if you add that up, that would be too much. But yeah, I mean, one has to be careful. So another assumption that we make is that cost grows with the path length from soma to synapses. So there is a synapse somewhere here. You have to count the distance along the branches, and that distance introduces a cost. Why does that cost exist? Well, has to be protein trafficking from the soma to synapses, not just once in development, but constantly for maintenance. Also, RNA is thought to be trafficked to synapses. And the longer the path is, of course, the longer the greater the cost. And in the opposite direction, the dendrite conducts electrical signals, which, of course, attenuate quite a bit. And so, again, the shorter the distance, the better, because the attenuation is less. And this is also a necessary assumption, because if this wasn't true, you could have an arbor which spirals out like this and covers the same territory, makes synapses in the same axons, yet you never see it. And of course, this is because the path length is much greater than what you had here. Of course, for that dendritic arbor, the path length is the shortest possible because there's a direct connection, but then the total length is too bad. So these two assumptions are necessary to explain arbor shape, and this has been found independently by Idan Segev and his group and his collaborators. But what's interesting, the assumptions are not just necessary, but sufficient. Just by making two rather generic assumptions, we can obtain the optimal arbor shape that is in agreement with experiment. And we have a mathematical argument in this paper that that does that, but rather than bore you with formulas, I thought I'd better give you an intuition of why this is so. So this is the cost side of the equation, so to say. Now we have to talk about the functionality that has to be maximized, and that's why we're paying the cost. And to talk about the functionality, the concept that we use is something we introduced with Armin, which is a potential synapse. And that's a proximity between a dendrite and an axon that can be bridged by a spine. So if you have a dendrite and you have an axon passing by within a couple of microns of that dendrite, then a spine can grow and make a connection. Okay, and we know that this happens not just in development, but in adult brain because of this experiments. Someone mentioned Carl Svoboda's experiment where a dendrite actually grows a spine and connects to that axon, thus turning a potential synapse, because those dendrites and axons are close enough, into an actual synapse in there. So this does happen in adult brains. And that's why rather than describing...
You should be, in all fairness, this is contentious. I mean, it's as contentious because there's another group, it's Wen's group, and you know this sort of very well. It's contentious because this may be in response to invasion of microglia entity. So there's an additional paper out of... what's the other one? Didi. It looks a little bit at that of spine, sort of processes from the inhibitory cell. At the same time, there was a paper publishing exactly the opposite result, and it may be contentious that having to do with, like I said, this one thing about microglia.
Okay.
It's just you know, full disclosure.
Okay, well, if you're going to talk about full disclosure, I can go for half an hour what kinds of control experiments were done on both sides. And if you're counting papers now, there are papers from Tobias Bonhoeffer that see the same thing as this.
But the only disagreement is about how often it happens, not whether it happens, right?
It became a difficult and convoluted argument, but my argument is that if one group sees something by one method and the other group doesn't see it by another method, it may also mean that that method is not as good.
Or it could mean that one reflects what's happening in reality and one doesn't. So you don't really know.
Right. And I'm not trying to give you a hard time, to say the least, but I just...
I don't have to defend Carl somebody.
But I think in fairness, right, in just you, and
Okay, well, you should address. But there are independent groups that have obtained this result, right? It's not just Carl's group. Now it's Bonhoeffer's group. Okay, so they got exactly the same result, and they studied different questions, but they do see this.
What is the result that's in contention? I got lost, which is.
So no one disagrees that this happens in development.
Exactly.
What's at contention is whether it happens in adult. There is another group.
How often it happens.
Or how often this. Well.
The question is how often it happens.
Well, order of magnitude far.
I mean, still it happens.
That's often.
There's no question it can't happen. There's an existence proof right there. Maybe it was because of the experimental manipulation that it happened, but it did happen.
Right.
That's what happens. How often it happens. Where it happens.
All right. Well, I'm a theorist. I don't have to defend the.
Which is the left wing view?
I'm sorry?
Which one is the left wing view?
So, but the point that I want to make is that if the connections can come and go, which they probably can, it would be difficult to describe functionality by the actual connections. But it might be better to describe functionality by this potential connection. And so if you have an arbor shown in red, again in the sea of axons that all run into the board just for simplicity, then only the axons that hit that spine reach zone, which is this gray corridor, they form potential synapses because they're reachable by spines. Okay? And they're the blue ones. And some of them get converted into actual synapses by actually hooking up to the spine, and those are actual synapses. They are shown in black. And so what we proposed is to describe the functionality of the arbor by the number of potential synapses it can make. And if you do that, indeed you can make a prediction about the total dendritic length, because a volume exclusion of axons, they take up a certain part of that spine reach zone, which is rather thin, and so you have to build dendrite longer and longer to fit in a sufficient number of axons to have as many potential synapses as you specify. And so the total dendritic length is just given by the total cross-sectional area of all potential axons divided by the spine length. Okay, so it's just simple geometry. And if you plug in the numbers, rough estimates from the mouse or rat cortex, you get more or less reasonable dendritic length, which is a couple of millimeters.
So does it matter for your argument whether this happens in adult or just in development? It seemed to me that you'd be just as happy if it's with a developmental process, and it certainly is, right?
That's true. If it wasn't predetermined which potential synapses become actual in development. But some people, well, there is some, evidence that, genes play a role in connectivity, and so one could say, oh yeah, well, the connections you make were predetermined from the very beginning. So even though all of this were potential synapses, it was clear from the beginning that this will be the right connection, which actually, there is a lot of evidence in different systems that happens. But what I want to claim is that a priori, that dendrite doesn't know which will be the appropriate axon. That is important. Whether that happens in adult or in development, as you pointed out, doesn't matter. So because a priori you didn't know which axon you wanted to connect to, you just want to maximize the number of potential synapses so that you have as many choices of actual as possible. And I want to point out that the number of potential synapses is about 10 times greater than the number of actual synapses. And this is the estimate that we got from geometry in the work that Armin did from using light microscopy data. And now, having those electron microscopy reconstructions, we could test this directly by just counting the axons in the volume reconstruction. And sure enough, it comes out to be about 10%. So, but what I want you to take out of this is that we can explain the total dendritic length by the need to make enough space for potential synapses to form. Now, once we know the dendritic length, it still doesn't determine the arbor radius or the size of the arbor region, because the same total length could be packed tighter in this kind of space, which we'll call compact arbor, where the whole region is tiled by the gray color, and that means that it's covered by the spine region. So almost every axon that goes through the arbor area can form a synapse with the dendrite if it wants.
The gray is where the dendrite is and where the spine could
reach. It's we call it spine reach zone. And or a sparse arbor where the span is so big that some axons just zoom through and they have no way in hell to connect with the dendrite. Okay? So that's still undefined, even though we set the total dendritic length. And so the question is, what determines the arbor? This is the point where we invoke the second assumption, the minimization of path length. And of course, this arbor has a longer path to the synapses on average than this one. And so it makes sense to compact the arbor, and it doesn't make sense to compact beyond the point where the spine ridge zone area is equal to this arbor area. So this compact arbor where the areas are matched is the optimal from the point of view of minimizing path length cost.
Question?
Yes.
So this question of two-dimensional versus three-dimensional representation, that will affect the definition of this compact arbor, right? If you were looking at this dendritic arbor in actually three dimensions,
so in three dimensions, what we do, we would just look in a projection. So just make a projection, because from the point of view of an axon, axon is more or less a straight line, and so it goes through. And so what it sees is actually a projection on a plane. Okay. Right. So the definition, yes.
Sorry, I lost the logical thread here. But isn't there another constraint that there are lots of these fibers that just need to run through and contact somebody else? In the compact arbor,
yes.
Everything got collapsed
yes.
as much as you could. But isn't there another constraint that you still need to...
Well, so blue dots actually don't make synapses in the red one, so they run still through.
But how do I know that I have enough of them? Isn't that a constraint?
No, but why? They don't contribute to functionality. If they don't synapse on the dendrite, they don't contribute to functionality.
But they contribute to functionality by contacting somebody else.
Yes.
Isn't there a constraint on how many fibers? You know, I can imagine that we're just talking about one cell, and... there's some global constraint of how much axons I have to run through to everybody else. Right?
So the axons that run through are the same in these two cases. Okay? So there is a sea of axons that run through. Now, in that sea of axons, given that sea of axons, I want to choose the arbor for that particular cell. I'm not changing any axonal position or contact of those axons with other cells. They're the same in these two examples. All I'm changing in that particular dendritic arbor.
The volume of the arbor is the same.
Yes.
So there is no optimization over the axons, so there is no constraint.
Not in what I'm going to tell you. We can do that, but in the story that I'm going to tell you, axons are given from above.
Yes. But isn't that true that you can still grow, axons can go through the gray area?
Yes. Yes, so blue dots are axons that went through the gray area and didn't make a synapse.
So do you have to worry about dynamics? That is, how long does it take the neuron actually to know that it's costing something to the region, grow or not grow? There's a time scale associated with what you're giving is basically the equilibrium final state, and it's
yes.
not quite clear. How you get dynamics that take you to that point?
It's not quite clear, and we intentionally did not worry about that in the first step. So we wanted to explain the final state.
Then you can imagine a frustration system where the system's trying to attempt to reach this minimum. But it's frustrating because other cells are trying to do it and they conflict with each other.
Perhaps, but we can explain this without invoking frustration. So, okay. So, and I think it's more parsimonious. But anyway, but we can discuss.
If you look at developing dendrites, they do look frustrated. Really, I just look at pictures.
Okay. So the prediction here is that in the optimal arbor, the area of the spine reach zone where the potential synapses are, should be matched to the area of the arbor. And we can test this because we have reconstructions of Purkinje dendrites, for example, and you can already see this is not a schematics anymore. This is a real reconstruction. And the gray area width is chosen in accordance with the scale. So you can already see that the gray region, the gray spine ridge zone more or less seals the whole area. So the areas are really matched. And we can divide the spine ridge zone by the arbor area, and the ratio is rather close to one.
I think your point is well taken that you do want to compact the dendritic spines, but the assumption is that the axonal volume is not as constrained as the dendritic volume. In other words, if you shrink the volume of the dendritic tree, you'd have to basically expand the size of the axonal tree in order to maintain the same level of connectivity. And if that's the case, then you're basically taking advantage of the fact that the axons are thinner. You know, they take up less volume, so they can...
Okay, we have to be careful here. So by volume, if you mean by volume the actual excluded volume, it's the same in both scenarios. So here the total length of the red branches is the same as total length of the red branches. Everything else is the same by definition. So the excluded volume does not change at all.
No, I'm talking about the
reach of the dendrites.
Reach, yes.
So I'll argue, in my view, for these cells, it's not crucial, and I'll explain why in a minute.
Well, I'm so still hung up on the that's my little bit. But it seems to me that there is something, some very non-trivial statement that is being made, which may well be sort of exactly the right thing. I want to understand what it is. Right? And the statement is locality, right? I can imagine that there are a zillion of cell adhesion molecules which somehow make different axons different flavors. So now I have this wires of different colors, and I can imagine that they're destined for certain dendrites, let's say, of the same color. And then the question is, are these different colors really mixed up and completely interspersed, or are they bunched into little bundles?
Perfect.
And you're basically saying that they're bunched in little bundles, which...
No. So I'm saying that I'm not arguing whether there are colors or not. People will debate that very aggressively. But I'm saying that if there are colors, or there is some other way to, say this is an appropriate axon or not, based on activity maybe, their location will be random. The dendrite does not know a priori where it will meet the right axons. There are systems where this is not true, but I'll argue that in the cortex, that is the case.
So you're saying it's random, and it seems to me that it's not random because it's compact there, right? But you have already said that,
but
of course, it's only 10%.
But you can only get 10%, yes.
Oh, but it could be a lot less than 10%, right? It could be 10 to the minus 4 fraction, right? It could be very sparse. So that bunching is big time, right? This is very significant.
Okay. Maybe we should make two more steps.
What's the difference in the cross-sectional area of the dendrite versus the axon?
10 times.
10 times, okay.
Is this a prediction of this is that dendritic interactions, the potential for those is not important in these cells with the compact arbors because...
Oh, there are no synapses between dendrites.
There's
so,
not, right. Yeah. So, okay, I see.
Inhibitory cells have gap junctions between them.
Yeah, I'm not talking about inhibitory cells. Well, protein should be. Not.
Well, just in the same vicinity as the Purkinje cells, there's another cell type, the molecular layer interneurons, which have a very different shaped dendritic tree. They look more like your sparse.
Exactly.
And they have, but they follow the same rules in the sense that they're flat. Right. So, so they're obviously following a different optimization parameters.
Yeah.
But In the interest of full disclosure. Yeah.
So since you brought up flatness, flatness also comes out of this optimization framework, of course, because if you had a three-dimensional arbor, it can always be made to have smaller total length, a smaller path length, by projecting it onto the plane. That is, if all axons run perpendicular to that plane. So flatness comes out automatically from that optimization framework.
Some Purkinje cells aren't flat.
That's true.
In some species, the Purkinje cells are
mistaken. Biology is an exception to everything. So, but basically, the point that I want to make.
Axons are parallel, but they're not.
So there could be a kinetic thing. There's just
some
kinetic
thing.
Well,
they don't have to be packed as many.
Also,
that's a
five
species. Well, in big fish, they're flat. In small fish, they're like pyramidal cells.
Okay. So, but the point that I want to make that from what we see, the space filling structure of the and the flatness of Purkinje dendrites is consistent with minimizing the path length cost and packing things. But for pyramidal cells, it's certainly not true. And what we're seeing is that for pyramidal cells, you can immediately see that this gray region, the spine ridge zone, is far from filling the complete area. And quantitatively, they take 30% or so of the region. And so this is a sparse design, not the compact one. And the question is, why? What accounts for that sparseness? Okay. Just to emphasize this point, there are axons that go through this region here. They have no chance of connecting to that pyramidal cell. So why didn't the pyramidal cell use a branch to hook up to those guys?
But instead,
these are basal dendrites of layer 2-3 pyramids. This particular one, I think, is from a rat, but we use also cats and primates. So what can account for the sparseness of pyramidal cells? And of course, the cost favors this compact structure. So we want to look on the functionality side. And to do that, I want to re-examine a little bit the assumptions that we made about the functionality. So what I told you before is that, well, you fix the number of potential synapses, and then you find the total length because of the volume exclusion argument. But why did we do that? Well, as actual synapses are only 10% of potential, you know, there are a lot of combinations that you can choose those 10% out of all the potential. And the more potential synapses you have, the more the number of combinations of axons that the dendrite can choose. And presumably, the more choices it has, it can find the better partners, or it can faster find or more appropriate partners, and so on. So we describe functionality by the number of potential synapses, because as it grows, so grows the number of combinations of axons that could be chosen. And in fact, we want to call the log of the number of combinations a connectivity repertoire, which is just like entropy in statistical physics. Okay? But the key point that I want to make is that that number of combinations or the connectivity repertoire doesn't just increase when you have more choices of actual synapses out of potential, but it also increases if you are given choices for potential synapses. So out of all axons, you have to decide which become potential. And that also contributes to the connectivity repertoire. And that's what will eventually explain the sparseness of the arc.
So would an example of that be that with this kind of geometry, axons that are going straight through perpendicular to that would have a different potential to ones that go horizontal relative to the basal dendrite?
So the orientation, of course, is important, but I don't want to bring it up right now, but that will become important, yes. So speaking now about the real axons and why I made the statement that I don't think that the dendrites know where the appropriate axons are, is, of course, we cannot know for sure because each brain is individual and so on. But all the data we looked at and all the shapes that we looked at, we don't see any indication of specificity of where exactly an axonal branch, by the way, shown here in gray in the dendrites in red, where exactly that branch runs within a layer we think is random. Of course, once you go, you know, a few hundred microns, then it matters. But on the scale less than 100 microns, the branch can run anywhere. The reason we think so is because even though even you could have a special positioning of that branch, by the way, most of the branches are pretty straight, as you can see. Okay, so that's a pretty special position maybe. But the dendrites can happen on any depth, at any depth, at any location. And so it seems impossible to arrange so that axon is in just the right position, not relative to just one dendrite, which would be required, but tens of thousands that it goes by. That's the reasoning why we think that this system is not designed on that level of specificity. So that level, the location where you find the appropriate axon is random. Also, what this thing illustrates is that the size of the axonal arbor is much larger than the size of the dendritic arbor. Okay, and if branches appear randomly on that scale, again, you don't know where that dendrite meets a branch from a similar axonal arbor of another neuron. That branch could be here or could be there, and there isn't much advantage to go further out because as long as you don't go any further than the size of the axonal arbor, you will still be encountering roughly the same axon. So it couldn't be that dendrite just grows out because there are more interesting axons further out. Of course, it would be the case if you go to a large scale because then there are topographic maps in the cortex. Once you get to the scale of a millimeter or so, then you would encounter new guys. But on this small scale of the size of the dendrite, which is only 200 microns, you can find the right axon anywhere pretty much by chance. So that's the assumption. And how does that help us? Well, to see the point, let's go through the steps in calculating the connectivity repertoire. Again, this is our sea of axons. Each circle is an axon shooting into the screen. And the first step is to choose potential synapses. And by choosing the shape of the dendritic arbor, the certain circles are shown in blue. They're the ones within the spine reach, within the spine's reach of a dendrite, and there become the potential synapses. And we have to go through all the possible conformations and count their number, and because they will all give different combination of potential synapses. So that's the first step, go over all possible shapes of dendrites. The second step is to choose actual synapses out of potential. So as I said, only 10% of those blue circles become black. But which ones, okay, there are many different combinations. And so one has to enumerate the number of ways of choosing actual inputs out of potential. That's the second step. But if this is all you would have done, you can go through the calculation and find out that you still get a compact arbor. And the intuition of why this happens, can come from statistical physics of polymers. If you have a free polymer, it has maximizes its entropy when it has an arbor radius which is square root of the number of monomers, just like in a random walk, which exactly gives you a compact arbor. So that's an analogy. So this isn't enough by itself to give a compact arbor. But we missed something here when we counted. Or in fact, we include something we should have missed. And this is these points here. Because what happened here is that in projection, two dendritic branches overlapped. And that means that the same axon that goes into the board was counted as a potential synapse twice, once for this branch and once for that branch. But this is all the same axon, so if you made an actual synapse here or there, would have given you the same functionality. And we call these locations double hits, and double hits basically what they do, they lead to an overcounting of the number of different connectivity combinations that one could have. Okay. And this is bad, of course, right? We had to choose the total dendritic length so that sufficient number of potential synapses could fit next to it. But now it turns out that we squandered those valuable slots next to a dendrite to the same axon several times, even though it would not add functionality. So what we need to do is to subtract those overcounts due to double hits that happen when in projection there is an overlap between dendritic branch.
So does that make any difference at this branch? I mean, I remember there is like a quarter power for
yeah, so we can talk about this. I just brought up this analogy to quickly illustrate this point. They do not, just to answer this question, if you consider branch polymer, you get a different exponent, but it still doesn't help you for two reasons, one of which is that this is basically a polymer in a melt. So self-avoidance with itself is canceled out by self-avoidance of other guys. So you still have to go to back to the...
There are some scalings for the polymer with self, for branching polymer with self-avoidance, right?
Yeah, I think it's 1/2.
It's close to 1/2.
Yeah, if it's no self-avoidance, it's 1/4. And then if it's self-avoidance, I think it's 1. But we can look at...
It's 7/13 or 6/13.
Yeah, there is that too, yeah. We can talk about this, but I think that what's crucial here is a flavor of self-avoidance, which is not the prohibition to, you know, the volume exclusion of dendritic branches, which I think is rather small and not significant, which also has to be compensated by other dendrites where it cancels out.
So wouldn't this also put a constraint on dendrites and that you would predict that they would tend not to cross each other like this?
That's my point.
Okay.
That's my point. That dendrites, but not like this, in a projection. And so now the whole thing really only makes sense in three dimensions.
Right.
So I've used this argument, you know, this two-dimensional representation just for simplicity so that I can draw pictures. But in reality, of course, the arbor is three-dimensional that we're trying to explain. That's the pyramidal arbor. Axons run in all possible directions. And it's important because in three dimensions, it's impossible to arrange the branches so that there are no double hits. You can arrange so there are no double hits in one projection, but there will be a lot of them in the other projection. That's the key. And to count those double hits, of course, you project the arbor and you go back to the 2D arbor and you count the number of those self-intersections, and it can be roughly estimated as by the density of dendritic branches. And of course, the density is less for the same total length if you spread the arbor radius. So you make a big arbor with the same dendritic length, you have fewer overlaps, you have fewer double hits, and so you subtract less from the connectivity repertoire.
But is there a flip, sort of a flip to this, which is if you look at thalamic cortical synapses, and this came up during Ed's talk, and there are instances, in fact, that we'll keep up for something, in which actually you get multiple contacts, and probably want multiple contacts for reliability. Right? So in that sense, you're saying you actually would rather prefer a contact, something that spreads in 3D and is relatively compact.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, so the issue of multiple contacts is an important one. So first of all, what I want to say is that this theory does not apply to every synaptic connection in the brain. There are many connections where the goal is not to maximize the connectivity repertoire, but to maximize the fidelity of the specific transmission between two cells. And the example in the cerebellum, for example, is a climbing fiber that wraps around the Purkinje cell and makes many, many synapses with the same partner forever, okay? Another example in the retina, in the fly retina, the photoreceptors onto large monopolar cell synapses, they just run parallel to each other and make synapses like crazy. They're not looking for diversity, they're looking for the fidelity of the transmission. But I think that for the cortical pyramidal cells and Purkinje cells in the cerebellum, what they're looking for is diversity. Now, it could still be that even in that situation between two pyramidal cells, you have several synaptic contacts. That could still happen. But we think that it happens in the minority of cases. And even if that happens, and you would want to have two or three contacts on average, it's still okay with us, because the important thing, what we're saying, is that you don't want to make all the synapses with one cell. That's the key. Whether it's one or two or three, it just will affect the numerical factor in our case.
So again, that's a very related comment, which also goes back to this color coding. So there's an assumption here that every dot or whatever little circle is distinct, right? As in comes from a different cell and a different functionality. But if we imagine that there's some sort of whatever population code or whatever, that whether you know that there are some groups of cells and groups of axons that are functionally more or less equivalent, then the question is, are these functionally equivalent axons sort of bunched together into some sort of a continuous map, in which case, right, you want to, with this compact arbor, you only contact sort of functionally related things, or are they all mixed up so that the picture is more like on the right, where you're assuming that every dot is different, and then you need to pick some subset of them, which again, you know, is sort of presumption in your whatever connectivity, well, whatever your entropy that you're defining.
Yeah. So it is true that we assume that appropriate axons are positioned randomly, but first of all, our argument is not going to be destroyed if it turned out that there are groups of neurons having the same functionality, because then you would just count double hits, synapses with neurons from those groups, right?
So maybe the reason I'm asking this, right, we are ultimately looking for the reasons to have these different architectures. And what I'm asking is, could it be that the two situations are different in terms of sort of correlation length in the functional identity of the axons that are running through? Could it be that in a compact case, functionally similar axons are close together, whereas in the other case, they're all mixed up?
So it could be if in both cases axons ran collinearly. So in cerebellum they run collinearly, and you can imagine that there is this bundle and that bundle and so on, okay? But in cerebellum we have this case, so we don't need to invoke that, so that's probably not. But in pyramidal cells, we would need to invoke the bundle idea. But the bundle idea does not work if axons run in all different directions, because if you have a bundle here, it will be destroyed 10 microns from here. Because remember that reconstruction thing? So you cannot preserve the bundle. That's why I think it's still correct to...
It also could be that a compact arbor is advantageous for one kind of one kind of neuron, and a sparse one is advantageous for one that needs to gather information from a larger area. Like in the retina, you find these look like the small retinal ganglion cells versus the large retinal ganglion cells.
So in the retina, that could be true, but I argue that in the cortex, this is not, because this scale, which is only 200 microns, is too small, and the topography does not change enough over that distance. Moreover, the size of axonal arbors is a millimeter. No, but the size of our axonal arbor is a millimeter. So until you go to that size, you're not going to encounter qualitatively different axons.
Different regions of the nervous system have different needs.
Well, that's right. In my theory, that's right. And my theory applies to the cortex and the cerebellum, not to the retina, okay?
Well, but if you apply it to the cerebellum, you've got the difference between the Purkinje cells and the molecular layer interneurons, which are making contact with the same parallel fibers, and yet the molecular layer interneurons would be, in my opinion, of the sparse type, and the Purkinje cells would be of the compact type.
Okay, I don't know what the rules are for connecting inhibitory cells in the cerebellum, so I cannot comment on that. Yeah, but we can discuss it afterwards. So basically what the point is that then avoidance of those double hits introduces statistical self-repulsion. And that's what we think gives you a sparse arbor. And you know, quantifying it, we have a theoretical framework which basically arises from mapping this on the theory of branch polymers, But in a nutshell, you minimize this quantity, which is cost minus connectivity repertoire, which is again is the log of the number of combinations. And the correction to that connectivity repertoire due to double hits is just the total length of the dendritic branches divided by the arbor radius squared, which is just like in the Flory theory for those who know, and it decays the arbor radius. And it's positive because it's minus of the negative correction.
How does one begin to deal with units here?
With what?
With units, where we need something to convert apples into oranges.
Yeah, well, there is a constant that converts.
But we know that the physics, that constant is sort of a fundamental constant. So not for scaling.
So what you're saying is that we don't know how to weigh those two terms, and that's completely true. But I can get the scaling result by assuming that there is some constant that weighs them. That's it. Okay? And so, yes, I cannot derive the proportionality, but I can still say that once you add those two things, you get a minimum, and that minimum has a power law. But to know the coefficient here, you need to know that constant.
But more than that, that constant has units. That constant has meaning.
Perhaps.
It's not just pi. I guess that's what I'm trying to...
Yes, but we...
No, Boris. The only thing that matters is the relative amplitude between these two terms, right, to do this optimization. You don't need a constant before one and a constant before the other to get the units right.
No, it's a scale factor.
Otherwise,
I agree there is a constant that relates how much it, you know, the cost is in terms of volume and how much gain there is in terms of survival, in terms of having an ability to remember more things and be more flexible. We don't know what that is, of course, because that's something that we cannot obtain independently at this point.
But it doesn't depend on the other like car.
That's my point. Exactly.
But the way it's written, they have different dimensionality indeed, right? One is dimensionless and the other one L0, L0, and you have to figure out what L0, L0, L0.
Just like in the statistical physics of polymers, there is...
It means that R in some dimensionless unit, R over R0 scales like L over L0 to the 2 things. That's what the scaling law is. And then you have to figure out what's R0, what's L0. That the 2 things relationship is what comes out to the scaling law. I don't know what you guys are trying to do.
Well, I guess I'm looking at the cost.
That's what the scaling law will tell you. It won't tell you what the cost.
I think what we're, you know, we know that we're looking for some generalization of temperature here, right? And we know that as you change it, there are phase transitions. Things change. So you can ask, could it be that in one animal, where connectivity is important,
yes,
you know, it's somehow high temperature regime and it's disordered, and in another animal where connectivity is not important, but the whole thing collapses.
That's exactly the point. The weight between these two terms is not a constant, a prefactor in front of one of them, but it's the ratio between them what we define.
Yeah. No, but Boris, this is the next question we want to ask. This is just the first step. I absolutely agree.
I've got a one-bit question. What's hotter, the cerebellum or the cortex?
What's what?
What's hotter?
Let me not answer this for a minute, okay? I mean, from this you could think that cortex is hotter, right? But let me just make one more step. Okay, so we can find the minimum and its scaling relationship. If scaling relationship without even knowing the constant, we can test it, okay? And we have data from basal reconstructions of basal dendrites of layer 2-3 pyramids from many primate species and also from different areas. And the cells tend to grow bigger if you go from the occipital cortex towards the front, roughly. And we can plot their arbor radius as a function of total dendritic length, which is just like the scaling plot for polymers. And this data exists for more than 2,000 cells. Each dot represents a cell, and you can see that the cloud more or less falls on a power law. And this is a log-log representation of the same data. The exponent here turns out to be 0.44, which is not exactly the same that what we get from the theory, but I'm not going to emphasize agreements and disagreements on this level. I think the key is that we can reproduce the scaling relation.
So it's pretty close to space relation.
Yeah, which would be 0.5, but anyway.
In two dimensions,
in two dimensions.
But not in three.
So, but the beautiful thing about this theoretical framework, we don't just get the scale of a scaling of Arbor dimensions. We can also predict the distribution of individual branches, because from the again statistics of polymers. We can calculate things like two-point correlation functions. Well, in biology, this two-point correlation function goes by a different name. It's called a Schall analysis. And what you do, you sit on some point in the arbor. Actually, in the original Schall analysis, you sit at the cell body, and you draw concentric spheres of different radii, and then you count the number of intersections between each of that sphere and the dendrites as a function of the radius of the sphere. And you plot, make this plot. So we modify this a little bit, of course, according to statistical physics conventions. You take not just one point on the cell body, but you choose the center on any dendritic segment and average over all the locations within the generation radius of the arbor. Okay? And so when you do that and you plot individual lines correspond to individual arbors that have been reconstructed in 3D, and they were all shrinkage corrected, which is important to get this right. And then we normalize this axis by the arbor radius, then all the lines collapse onto a single curve. And that single curve is, of course, just like in polymer physics, is given by this kind of expression where there is an exponential term, and then there is a power law right in front of it, and that describes this rise of that thing. And here is a log-log view of that. And the exponent of that rise is related to the exponent in the arbor scaling relation.
When you say one arbor, do you mean one neuron, or do you
one
mean
neuron.
One primary branch?
One neuron. One whole neuron, yeah. And so we tested that this scaling relation does indeed work, that the power law here is actually related to the power law on the previous slide, and that's, of course, encouraging. But also we can get, of course, the whole shape. And so the Schall analysis has been done for 50 years, and there are thousands of papers that use
it. Is it still basal dendrites of like 2-3 coronal cells?
Yes, in cat. But this is, from what I know, this is the first principal derivation of the curve that describes the Schall plot. And it's not just the relative position of the branches that we can account for, but also the tortuosity of individual branches, of course, because that's what you can do in polymer physics, and you can measure tortuosity by relating the path length to the Euclidean distance. And you can see that they're in the stretched regime, so to say, which is very different from a random walk, of course, that the path length roughly scales with the Euclidean distance, and the deviation is described by a scaling relation. Of course, the spread is such that we cannot get the exponent exactly right. But the neat thing about this exponent, and sorry for exposing you for this free energy expression that actually on which this theory is built, but the point is that this is the cost term, and small l is the path length, and big L is the total length, and beta is this temperature constant that Boris is interested in. And then this term describes the entropy gain or loss due to straightening of dendrites. And when I say the stretch regime, that's why I put this term rather than the R-squared term. And this is the Flory-like term that comes from double hits. And in the sequential optimization that we do, we first find the optimal path length by balancing these two terms, and it makes a prediction about how the tortuosity should behave, and that's where this cost-dependent scaling exponent, how cost increases with path length, relates to the tortuosity. And theoretically, we thought it was 0.5. This measurement gives 0.42. And again, I don't think we're at a stage where we can really go and compare exponents to the second significant digit. But the point is that this whole framework is self-consistent, and it forms a really tight structure.
So I just missed that. So the correlation, the Schall analysis correlation function, that form, functional form, no, the theoretical form.
Yeah.
That comes from what? So is this a branched holomer model?
Yeah, that's a polymer, a generic expression for a polymer.
Self-avoiding branched polymer?
Yeah, whether it's self-avoiding or not will determine the exponents here. But the general two-point correlation function, when you maximize entropy, that's what you would have.
Okay, but so I'm just still missing. So this value that you have in nu, that's just generic for a branched polymer?
The value of nu that we get is not, because it's a branched polymer with this interesting kind of repulsion, which is fluoride-like, but it's in like 2D fluoride-like. But it also depends on the cost.
So we're thinking then about what basically you're sampling from that free energy. Is that the idea? The free energy expression that you wrote down? I'm just trying to define the ensemble of branched polymers. So basically you're
yeah, so there's a branch polymers. Why did it? Yeah, there's a branch polymer that all have the same total length.
Yeah.
They maximize entropy for which the correction comes from the double hits.
Yeah.
Another correction comes from the fact that if you have straight branches, you lose an entropy. That's this thing. And there is a path length cost, which is this. That's the mathematical. That defines the thing. Okay? And once you solve it, you first optimize in respect to L and then in respect to R, then you get the scaling relation. So it all seems to be self-consistent. Of course, more measurements are needed and more thinking is needed. But at this stage, we can go back and, you know, then if you're convinced that those double hits are important or avoiding them is important, then, you know, why aren't Purkinje cells sparse? And the reason could be due to the temperature, but we think that it's just the geometry. Because all the axons run perpendicular to the board, if the arbor is flat, there are no really double hits. Or in other words, double hits can be avoided by placing the branches so that they don't self-intersect. So it's just a geometry of the fact that the force, so to say, the statistical force that is created depends on which orientation the axons run. If all axons run in the board, then it doesn't create that force. But if axons run in all different directions, then the force is created and a sparse arbor is the best one for Randolph cell. So that is what I want to tell you about the arbors. I also want to tell you that the same principles work for distribution of synaptic weights. But because you're probably all thinking about lunch now, I'd rather skip that and just go to the conclusion where, you know, we could, we think that we can explain a lot of measurements on the arbors by maximizing the feeder repertoire while minimizing wiring cost. We think that the isotropic distribution of axons in the cortex is crucial to explain sparseness, and of course when axons run in the same direction, then you can get away with the compact Purkinje dendrites. And think that I didn't tell you about the exponential distribution of synaptic size, which we measure from electron microscopy, also falls out from that same framework when you maximize information storage capacity under volume constraint. And this is a truly interdisciplinary collaboration, so it involves a card-carrying physicist, like Shura Grosberg, and through biologists like Guy Elson, who reconstructed those basal dendrites, but also people that are starting both sides of this divide. So that's Tran Nguyen, who just got a PhD with me, Armin, who is in the audience, is a professor at Northeastern, and Yuri Mishenko, who wrote an algorithm for three-dimensional reconstructions of the electron microscopy images that I showed you. Thank you very much.
I'm so curious how the growing dendrite knows that there's this cost being incurred. That I can see how the framework you set up explains this, but there's the actual mechanics of how this thing grows, and let's say at some point that you do have a near miss. How is there information communicated between two dendritic branches that
somehow say that, you've got a double hit and I've got to shift my position.
So
without some mechanism like that, I don't see how the neurons can explore the space and find it and find the space.
Well, this is a very good question, and our intentional focus was not on development because we think that development is very complex and, you know, it's a next stage. So how could this interaction having to do with double hits be actually implemented? I'll tell you right away that in the cortex, we don't know. But in the flies, we know how that could happen. So in flies, there is this molecule called DSCAM, which is a gene that can be alternatively spliced. And what that means that there could be, in this case, tens of thousands of different isoforms of that molecule, and each neuron may express, and people think that each neuron does express, a specific, stochastically chosen, but specific only to it combination of those isoforms. So it expresses 5 or 10 of those. And no other neuron expresses the same. Then, if a neuron touches itself, it knows it, because those molecules go to the membranes and they stick out, and there is a dimerization between them that sends a signal.
You could also say that STDP-like mechanisms provide a sort of statistical way of, you know, for example, you've never got an OTAP, but, you know, the axon will not come down and connect the dendrites under STDP rule, because right after you fired, you see a spike coming in like 1 millisecond, and then you're in the LTD phase of the STDP rule. So if you posit some kind of local STDP on the branch dendrites where one EPSP comes in a little bit earlier than another due to having common synaptic input, that there's a competitivity mechanism involving calcium. That would be the activity dependent story.
There's actually good evidence for that, for the Kinji cells, because in development they are often arbors that are slightly off and parallel, but emanating from the same dendrites. And they get pruned during development, and this is activity dependent. Mm-hmm. So this, the flatness of the arc develops over time by pruning of exuberant parallel branches.
The DS campaign is only for self-avoidance, right? Not for getting double hits, avoiding double hits.
No, but the question is, how can one make an arbor that would be sparse? I thought that was the how would you?
I think you were envisioning, you were asking about a mechanism that would really tell whether or not to double hit.
But you could do that by just building a sparse arbor and then hoping that then.
I'm just saying you weren't answering the same question.
Oh, sorry, then I. No, I don't know of a way to.
It's also in the retina, right? The PSCAM thing is in the retina also, right? Is there any paper about that?
Well, but it's expressed not on a neuron-specific basis, but on a class-specific, cell-type-specific basis. But there are no... So we were very excited, of course, when we learned about DSCAMs, but our excitement got diminished when we found out that the molecule is not alternatively spliced, at least not with as many isoforms in the mammals. And also, there is no evidence as of yet that it could be diffusible. So what people know now is that it's attached to the membrane. It could still be cleaved, of course.
Well, it's a cell adhesion molecule, right? That's the CAM, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
It's a cell adhesion molecule.
Still can be cleaved. Right? One side will be cleaved, the other one won't, and then it will still react.
I think the mechanism is more responsible for one cell type avoiding the inside from another cell, from the same cell type.
But also itself. No, but also, so I think that paper shows, Maslin's paper shows.
So does this put constraints, does the density of axonal information put a constraint on how big the arbor could get before it becomes sparse? And if a Purkinje cell kept growing and growing and growing, would it eventually be forced to become sparse?
it's branched.
No.
No?
Right, I mean, at least in this framework, if you had the array of axons, well, I mean, if you ran out of new axons, then it will just stop. But if you didn't run out of axons, then you would just keep growing and covering more and more territory, right?
Right, but in the pyramidal cells, or the cells, the layer two cells you showed, I mean, as they grow further, they would, each, as the branches grow further, they would have to have more and more dendritic branches in order to cover the increased area that results from growing further from the cell body, is that?
Yeah, but they can still do it sparsely.
See, that's right, but I thought you meant they have to be compact, so I thought that...
The Purkinje have to be compact.
I see, but the pyramidal cells don't have to be compact.
No.
Okay.
So I guess you've raised an inverse question, which is why the axon orientation is random in the cortex?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So of course, this explanation of the theory by itself does not depend on that. So as soon as it's random, we can say, you know, maximize connectivity to repertoire. But the explanation of why Purkinje and pyramidal cells is different, of course, relies on the fact that, you know, in the cerebellum, all axons were arranged in one direction, and the cortex, they weren't. So why couldn't cortex be built like a cerebellum where all axons run in one direction? And I think the answer to that is that when you do that, you sacrifice the connectivity repertoire of axons rather than dendrite. Because now axons can only hit the dendrites that are down that one direction. And if they decide to go, connect to another dendrite, they can't. So why can...
This raises Boris's question, correlation links. Is this more delicate thing?
Right, so for some reason in cerebellum, it was possible to sacrifice the entropy of the axons. And part of the reason could be that cerebellum has very high convergence. So the number of, you know, convergence-divergence ratio in cerebellum is like 1,000. So, you know.
In a mouse.
So there are many more granule cells and their axon parallel fibers than Purkinje cells. But in the cortex, of course, it's one-to-one because each pyramidal cell has an axon dendrite. So maybe that's part of the reason.
So presumably in the cerebellum, the Purkinje cell dendrites are changing their configuration rather than the axons kind of twisting. They're cable, but the parallel fibers kind of twist.
Changing as a function of what?
The parallel fibers stay parallel.
The parallel fibers stay parallel. They don't kind of wind rounds like that.
Not that I know.
And all the combinatorics is done in a dendritic shape.
You mean in development?
Yes. All the combinatorics of different receptive fields from that axonal field is done in the Purkinje cell configuration.
Well, that's the dogma.
Okay.
You started with the elegans and then you abandoned it. And, is the fact that in some sense the space is not constrained that says there's really nothing of interest?
You got a bigger budget
from these small animals.
So the reason I didn't talk about C. elegans is because I don't have the time to talk about everything. But in C. elegans, the story is even simpler than that, because the connectivity is deterministic, and we think that the length of all the neurons and their positioning is determined by the actual connectivity. So there is no space for entropy. So just minimizing energy in physics analogy. That's at least what...
Wire length,
right. That's all there is to it. Okay, but when you go to higher animals, because the connectivity is not predetermined, you have to include the entropy into the energy, and you end up with the free energy. So it's kind of like in physics, I think. Maybe it's because I'm a physicist, but at least that's what we see.
So do these models assume an interspine distance, which is the same between the different types of neurons?
Interspine distance.
I'll spine with the same thing.
No, interspine, the spacing of the spine, that may vary.
I'm not sure where this was assumed. I mean, we certainly see difference in spine density between dendrites, for example.
Usually going in our distal, and you have a spine-free zone near the stroma, which is 10 microns or
But actually, that observation could be explained by this, because all of those possible synapses would be double hits, because the density it didn't work. Anyway, the density of branches is so high that close to the soma, you're not likely to encounter any new fresh axons that haven't been synapsed by someone else. So that actually could be.
But that's also mainly an inhibitory zone.
That's true too. Yeah.
I think you can figure out the interspike distance by knowing the exactly length of spine, diameter of axon, and the sparseness of the tumor, and then it becomes a combination of those.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's basically about.
Well, the spines aren't regularly.
Right, they average
distance.
Yeah. I suggest we take a break.
This is going
to stay here for a week, right? So, I guess people will be very glad to Sorry.
Yeah, before you guys leave, there is an announcement that just came in. There was an announcement yesterday about the, for those of you who like to get excited about things other than the brain, there was an announcement yesterday about the discovery of 10 new extrasolar planets. And scientists at the UCSB were part of a collaboration, and there will be a talk about that today at 4 p.m. at the Institute in the main seminar room where we met yesterday. So those of you who want to hear about extrasolar planets and life outside of Earth and things like that, you're welcome to go at 4 p.m. the main seminar.
It's a new problem.
You'll find it. That seems invisible.
Thank you.